Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Orthodoxy is sustained. Two guests today, both talking about different aspects of life in California. Laura Jadid will talk about the hellscape that is San Francisco and the reactionaries' plans to fix it. You probably couldn't tell there were two sets of air quotes in that sentence. And Yasha Levine will talk about water in California, one of several larger contexts for the Los Angeles fires. Much of this may not be news to Bay Area listeners, but the rest of us have been hearing endless stories about how San Francisco, a once beautiful, if excessively liberal city, has been turned into an outcropping of hell thanks to those very liberals. But allegedly saner forces in the pay of tech billionaires have some ideas of how to set things straight. San Francisco has some problems, yes, but many of them have been caused by the very tech billionaires who now propose to fix it, drawing on some seriously reactionary politics. Here with more is the journalist Laura Jadid, who visited San Francisco recently and survived to report on her findings in the New Republic. Laura Jadid grew up surrounded by the right. Her parents were Ayn Rand followers, and she was, as she says, a card-carrying libertarian in her younger days. She even did a stint with the 82nd Airborne in Afghanistan. She gave up the conservative politics, but it left her with a lifelong fascination with that side of the political spectrum. A bit of background for the non-Bay Area audience that might not come immediately clear in the interview. London Breed served as the mayor of San Francisco from 2017 until January 8th of this year. She was defeated for re-election last November by Daniel Lurie, an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune. Here's Laura Jadid with more. By some accounts, we're risking our lives every time we step out into the streets of Brooklyn, but you took an even greater risk by visiting San Francisco. I hear it's just hellish. You survived, though.
Somehow.
Yeah, how bad is it?
Oh, awful. The streets are, paved with excrement, tent cities everywhere, fentanyl dealers begging you to buy fentanyl. Of course, I didn't see any of this, although I did look just about everywhere I could. The Tenderloin wasn't great. There are a few blocks of real human misery there, but every city has that. For the most part, every other place I visited in San Francisco was incredibly clean. Anybody who thinks that's filth would simply die instantly if they came to Brooklyn, where I live.
This is not to deny that San Francisco has some real problems like homelessness, insane rents. There's some real serious problems there that we can't dismiss.
Absolutely. I believe it does have the highest rate of unhoused people, and it also has the highest rate of unsheltered people, which sounds the same. But for example, New York City has a very high rate of unhoused people, but a lot of homeless shelters. And so people have a roof over their head. That's not the case in San Francisco. And that is a real problem. Housing costs out of control. And they do have a very high rate of property crime. That is accurate. Violent crime, not so much.
Yeah, and a lot of these problems stem from the very demographic that now wants to save the city from all these ills, right?
Yes. It turns out that when you decide that a city is going to be the mecca for tech, a lot of people move there and then housing prices go up. And that's not necessarily because of progressive politicians. That's because of supply and demand, which I hear they like a lot. So it's odd that they don't know that.
Have a lot of these tech people left? There's a lot of talk about San Francisco losing population. Who did leave?
There's been a lot of talk about that. You see a lot of articles from people who left. It doesn't seem like that's really the case. Over COVID, there was a population decrease, as there were in many big cities. That is reversed. It's on the upswing again. While it is true that a lot of companies that were headquartered in San Francisco shut down their offices, that was because a third of the city was working remote. And it turns out that when everyone's working remote, it doesn't make sense to keep office space. This is not a problem unique to San Francisco at all.
Over the last several years, there's been a brewing revolt of the haves. There was a school board recall. They took down Chesa Boudin. Tell us that prehistory to what you're looking at now.
To preface, the thing that everyone I talked to seems to agree kicked it off was the school board recall, which stemmed from what I think are some legitimate parent concerns, or at least they were harnessed by what I would consider some dubious actors. Some legitimate concerns were harnessed. At the time, the school was engaged in a process of renaming schools, which generally speaking, can be a very good idea, but they were using this extremely slipshod Wikipedia-based method for figuring out what needed to be renamed. Paul Revere, Dianne Feinstein, just two examples of people who were flagged, who, like, you might not love Dianne Feinstein, but I'm not sure that she's problematic enough to warrant a renaming. So that was irritating, especially because this was in 2021 and parents were worried about schools not opening. They felt like the school board had backwards priorities. The school board also experimented with removing algebra from middle school in the name of racial justice. It's more complicated than that, and I won't get into the nitty-gritty on it. But what I'm trying to say is that there were some legitimate concerns here, and those concerns were harnessed to have one of the city's first recalls in a very long time. It was a relatively low turnout recall election, but it was decisive. I believe 3 school board members were recalled. And then the people who spearheaded that recall moved immediately into recalling Chesa Boudin, an extremely progressive DA who had run on harm reduction and social justice, but basically progressive reform. This is when I think the exaggerations really started about how bad the city was. And again, as you say, real problems, absolutely, but not new to Chesa Boudin's time in office. And it just kind of snowballed from there. This group that got momentum has continued on this quest to convince everybody that all of San Francisco's problems are the problems of progressives, and San Francisco hasn't actually been that progressive for many decades, governmentally speaking.
Yeah, well, that's worth a word or two, because, you know, that's the assumption is that it's so progressive. People say that about New York City, too, and we've had some pretty right-wing, or at least center-right forces here, and I'm assuming similar in San Francisco.
Very much so, yes. Moderates have been in charge of the mayor's office for decades. One of the big bugbears of the moderate, so-called moderate movement, I prefer anti-progressive, but the anti-progressive movement was Dean Preston, who was the first democratic socialist to hold office since the 70s. And for a city that has this reputation of being just extremely progressive, you've got mayors like Willie Brown and London Breed and Daniel Lurie, who recently won. The city was progressive in the 60s and has kind of been riding that reputation ever since. A lot of what's happening is the result of moderate policies, and it's really very convenient, this one-way ratchet where things go wrong, progressives are accused of causing it, government swings more moderate, problems increase, progressives blamed again, and it's a real problem.
To hear the discourse, you'd think the city is run by the reincarnation of Che Guevara, but
not the case.
They've been cutting social spending like crazy. Even as needs rise, rents rise, and levels of desperation rise, the answer is always to cut the budget.
Absolutely. This is also one of the only places that has enacted that great conservative fantasy of drug testing welfare recipients. I would call that one of the more conservative policies that's been proposed in this country, and San Francisco has that.
So now there's this group of civic-minded venture capitalists, let's call them, Michael Moritz, Gary Tan, you read about, and they have around them this network of plutocrat-funded advocacy organizations, some of them actually quite right-wing or with ties to the national right-wing. So yeah, who are these moderates?
For based on the feedback I got from the article I recently wrote, other cities may be able to relate here. These are a bunch of groups that have very anodyne, kind of generically liberal-sounding names, Neighbors for Better San Francisco, Together SF, Grow SF. Their websites talk a lot about, you know, mitigating climate change, making the city more livable. And then when you dig a little bit more deeply, you find stuff like a Law and Order platform and bringing in the National Guard to solve the homeless problem and things that, again, really affiliate with conservatives. And when you look into it, when you look into the source of their funding, you do find, especially Never Trump Republicans, but not exclusively Never Trump Republicans, who are pouring money in. One of the biggest sponsors of that group, Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, is on the board of Betsy DeVos's school organization, big proponent of private schools and eliminating public schools. This is not me just calling anybody that I don't agree with a conservative. These are genuinely conservative people who are posing as moderates, and it's not accurate.
They do have to assume that pose because even if San Francisco is not the constituency of Che Guevara, it is nonetheless, you know, politely liberal, and you couldn't be a raving reactionary and get very far in San Francisco. Is that the case?
Absolutely. And I think that's part of what's so clever about this is this posing as we're Democrats. Everyone here is a Democrat. It's weird that you would not call us. Would you call us like conservative when this is San Francisco and we're all liberal here? We just think that it's gone too far. And the result of this is that not only are conservative forces on the rise in the country writ large, but as this anti-progressive movement takes hold on the liberal side of politics, it basically makes it so that there's nowhere progressives can go, where any kind of idea that advocates for, say, a robust social safety net or harm reduction instead of carceral answers to the drug problem that have been shown not to work. There's no place for that. The Overton window is shifting, and it's thanks to people like this who are posing as moderates and simply aren't.
Now, London Breed did talk about defunding the police some time ago, and she completely reversed herself, right? Became a big cop promoter?
Yes, and that the evolution of London Breed could stand in for the evolution of San Francisco politics over the last few years. She did come in on a platform of harm reduction. She supported a lot of Chesa Boudin's policies. She opened, or at least approved of opening, a place called the Linkage Center in the Tenderloin, which was centered completely around harm reduction. It was a place where people who were unhoused could go. It was a place where people could use drugs safely. And the overdose prevention rate in this center was 100%. It's counterintuitive to have a government-funded facility where drug use happens, but we know that carceral systems don't work. We know that arresting drug addicts doesn't work, especially because when you release them, they go back on the street, they shoot up again, and then they die of overdoses, which when this center shut down, when after London Breed reversed her policy, overdose rates skyrocketed, and they were up over the year of 2023 when the rest of the nation, they were down.
To the hardliners, anything like that is promoting drug abuse. And to them, the only thing to do is just throw people in jail, right? But if the overdose rate takes the course you describe, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but you almost suspect that's what they want.
I think there's that real punitive streak where, yeah, people who are addicts are criminals and they deserve what they get. As you go further into the people behind these groups, as you kind of start to get up to the less subtle tech bros, people like Balaji Srinivasan, the way they talk about people who are addicted to drugs or unhoused is just pure sheer contempt. These people are more worried about punishing than they are with rehabilitation. And that, again, not a progressive or even liberal policy position.
These civic-minded VCs had a mayoral candidate, Mark Farrell. He didn't win, but what was his platform? What was he about to do?
Yeah, well, that thing I mentioned earlier about wanting the National Guard to come in to deal with the problem of unhoused people, that was him. That was an explicit, on his website, policy that he endorsed. He wanted to also cut taxes and make it easier for real estate developers to develop. Part of this movement that some of you might have heard of called YIMBY, the Yes in My Backyard movement, which sounds amazing on the surface. Hey, we don't have enough housing. We should build more housing. And the best way to do that is the free market. And that's where things start to fall apart because what you get is a bunch of luxury housing, which doesn't actually bring down the cost of housing for the rest of us. Studies have shown this anyway, but that was Mark Farrell's platform was basically law and order and build baby build. And it didn't work out because he ended up having to pay the largest ethics fine in San Francisco history because he used a slush fund from one of the propositions that one of these groups was running. He basically used their fundraising for one of the propositions on the ballot to help elect him. And that scandal pretty much torpedoed his case to become mayor.
I'm speaking with the journalist Laura Jadid. Now, the winner, Daniel Lurie, is an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune. So it's, you know, the shades of Michael Bloomberg here.
Yes. Lurie has a background in philanthropy that is real, but mostly what he is known for is being born with a lot of money. These groups, these anti-progressive groups, basically there were three candidates that they were okay with. There was London Breed, there was Daniel Lurie, and there was Mark Farrell. And a lot of them were campaigning on basically, they have ranked choice voting. So the idea was, look, rank them 1, 2, 3 in whatever order you care about. Just don't rank Aaron Peskin, the progressive candidate. That does appear to be what happened.
And what is Lurie about to do?
He's put Sam Altman of OpenAI onto his transition team. So right there is a pretty good indication of where all this is going. He's very friendly to tech, crypto, AI, and has a lot of that law and order stuff that Mark Farrell ran on, a little bit less strident in tone, but we'll see. We'll see what he does. He is definitely a pick from the moderate or anti-progressive side.
This narrative of the normals versus the bizarros, how's that work? Who's promoting that?
Well, this is the brilliance of it. Again, their ideas are quite, for San Francisco too, even given the moderate history, are quite reactionary in comparison. But they're not presenting it that way. They're presenting it as we're the normal folks and we just want normal things like law and order and clean streets. And who's against that? And of course, the answer is the bizarro world of the progressives who apparently love it when people are addicted. That's why they support harm reduction. And they love it when streets are dirty. That's why they don't want homeless sweeps. By framing it in this way, it really makes it difficult to communicate One of the things that I found most striking in researching this article was I talked to a gentleman named Mark Dietrich, who's very well known and slightly controversial in San Francisco for being on the side of the moderates. And then Dean Preston, the DSA member who was running for supervisor, narrowly lost. But they both, when I talked to them, agreed that the correct approach to the overdose problem was a combination of enforcement and harm reduction. But that's not a conversation they're ever going to have, because this kind of normal versus bizarro framing short circuits discussion in a way that honestly should be very familiar to all of us on a national stage. It really echoes the MAGA strategy of labeling your enemies as not just disagreeing, but anti-American.
Let's place these people in a larger political context, a very unpleasant larger political context. Tan of Y Combinator, big VC operation, is an effective accelerationist. What in God's name does that mean?
Effective accelerationism is one of those things where if you start even trying to describe it, you sound so crazy that it almost undermines your overall point. It is an extremely online theory about technology that says that all technological innovation is good. Any kind of break on technological progress is not just wrongly, not wrong-headed, but immoral, evil even. And the people who think that perhaps there are some dangers to technology like large language models, that perhaps cryptocurrency isn't the best way to use money. This is the degrowthers or decels, which, you know, obviously trying to echo incels there.
Oh,
yes.
God.
So their goal is just, unfettered, unlimited technological growth and damn the torpedoes. They claim it's based on the laws of theoretical physics, which is, to me, very funny.
This is all tied up with Mark Andreessen, too. How's he fit in?
Yes, he actually wrote something called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto, which is one of the primary texts of this effective accelerationist movement, which basically says what I just said and which I describe in the article is basically Ayn Rand on more uppers, but in space. It talks about things like eventually transcending the flesh.
Not in the Christian way, though, right?
No, not in the Christian way. And to be fair, I believe the other foundational text by and I'm not making this up, Beth Jesus on the internet is more explicit about this desire to transfer intelligence into silica-based something so that we can travel the stars as immortal beings. And again, this sounds insane. And the thing that's distressing is that this isn't just some weird fringe internet phenomenon anymore. This is all tied up with Mark Andreessen, with Peter Thiel, with J.D. Vance, with Elon Musk. These people are gaining power. It's a cult, and they're gaining very serious national power at this point.
Musk is obsessed with going to Mars, so is this part of the project?
Not explicitly, but it's all part of that same kind of milieu as we need to get into space. We need to spread among the stars. And I'm personally, I actually think going into space is great. I am personally not against that.
I agree. I think a lot of people on the left don't like space, but I'm for space.
I'm pro-space, broadly speaking. I'm not going to allow Elon Musk to determine my position on space. Thank you very much.
But, you know, it's funny how these guys like Bezos and Musk, they're not like, you know, the old plutocrats of the Gilded Age built cathedrals and libraries and universities. And these guys just want to launch themselves into space. It's a whole new generation of robber baron we're dealing with here.
It is exactly that. Yeah, these people have no concept of any kind of giving back. I mean, I feel like a lot of us on the internet captured this whole attitude when the gentleman in California, I'm forgetting his name, but he tweeted desperately asking for any private firefighters to come save his house specifically after he posted bragging about not paying property taxes and asking for taxes to be lowered. I mean, this is the mentality. It really is like an every man for himself. Screw you if you can't afford it. That must mean that you're not very smart. It's really gross.
Now, Andreessen is also a fan of Nick Land. What's Land's worldview?
Yes. So Land is part of something called the Dark Enlightenment and the creator of traditional accelerationism, which basically is the idea that society is falling apart and the best thing we can do is to make that happen faster so that we can get to whatever lies beyond it. And what they think lies beyond it is monarchy. They believe the Enlightenment was a mistake. The dark part is almost a reverse Enlightenment. And their goal is to have sort of sovereign city-states, which are run like a corporation with a CEO with broad powers and a board who has general influence, but not really any kind of say in the day-to-day. It really is very monarchical. Again, as ridiculous as this sounds, they have started to create this. There is a place called Prospera in Honduras. There is a thing called Zuzulu. They get together semi-regularly for these large conferences. I'm forgetting the one that Brian Johnson, the guy who wants to live forever and uses his son's blood in the attempt to do so, he's got one. That one, there's no regulations on drug testing. You can just test whatever drugs you want. And this apparently is the beautiful future that they want for everyone. No word on what happens to people who are deemed unfit to join these sovereign societies. They never seem to explicitly say what happens to the unwanted and unwashed.
It's funny, and I used to read about this stuff, the seasteading, the secessionist stuff. Some years ago, Patry Friedman, Milton's grandson, had a piece in a Cato magazine about basically seceding from society because he had come to believe that libertarianism could never win elections because most people don't like libertarians or their worldview.
He's not wrong.
No, he's certainly not wrong. But here, these people, that was, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, that piece that Friedman wrote in the Cato magazine. And here, these people are really very close now to the political mainstream or the levers of power. They've got friends in the White House or the imminent Trump White House. It's really quite alarming how close these people have come to realizing their sick and demented fantasies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's horrifying. And I feel like it is still, it's getting somewhat more media attention, but it's still very much overlooked. While everyone's been freaking out about Trump's declaration that he's not ruling out military force, the case of Greenland, Canada, Panama, etc., the same press conference where he said that, he announced a $20 billion foreign investment in a center for AI. And he would like to expand the electrical grid to accommodate this, which, of course, means putting more fossil fuels into the sky at a time when doing that is currently destroying LA. And basically, he's talked about something called freedom cities that very much echo this idea of a network state, of a laissez-faire, the laws don't apply, CEO-run cities. This is not fantasy land anymore. This is very much a real threat, as insane as that sounds.
Yeah, and then a guy like Curtis Yarvin, who used to be considered really nuts and marginal, you know, when he was blogging as Mencius Mulbug, he was extremely marginal. Interesting, curious figure, pretty lively prose style, but one doesn't want to get him anywhere near power. He's an avowed monarchist, so Yarvin is a guru to a lot of these folks.
Yes, yeah, no, he appears on their podcast, they reference him often. Nick Land and Curtis Yarvin are the two fathers of the Dark Enlightenment. They are explicitly pro-monarchy. And it's gaining traction among the tech bros, or techno-fascists, as some might call them.
Yeah, when I was in college, I was in a strange organization called the Party of the Right, back when I was a young reactionary. And we revered Charles I, who got executed, and his execution was deemed a tragedy for humanity. Yarvin reveres Charles I, too. We were a weird marginal formation at one point, and now, through people like Thiel and all these tech bros, they're really having some serious political influence. They have a very substantial presence in the Republican Party, likely a presence in the Trump White House. These are extremely alarming developments. San Francisco is just kind of an experimental ground for them.
Yeah, and explicitly so. Gary Tan, who we haven't talked about too much, but is a kind of a mover and shaker. Y Combinator is an incubator for startups, and I would also call it a political incubator at this point in many, many ways. But he has explicitly said that San Francisco is a test ground for what to do elsewhere. If it can work in San Francisco, it can work anywhere. And it is working in San Francisco, not as well as they'd like. They've poured millions of dollars. They've poured more money into San Francisco politics between 2020 and 2024 than in the entirety of San Francisco politics from 2000 to 2020 combined. And all of that money has bought them a moderate majority on the Board of Supervisors. It's bought them another moderate mayor. But it hasn't bought them victories in everything. It certainly hasn't bought them victories in ballot measures. And yet, by chipping away at it brick by brick, they're getting there. And of course, a couple million dollars is couch cushion change to these guys. And that's the real issue here, is the fact that these people have just mind-boggling amounts of money and are happy to throw all of it at getting their way. And it's working because there's no safeguards in place to prevent it.
And to conclude, you make an important point towards the end of your New Republic piece. Far too many liberals cast themselves as defenders of the status quo, expending more energy assuring us that things are okay, and worse, take up counterproductive au courant causes like banning middle school algebra, rather than asking the hard questions that tech bros are answering so confidently yet poorly. Could you talk about that some?
unfortunately, we are on a national level living out the consequences of just liberal abdication of anything that could even be remotely considered progressive. They are truly the entire Biden and then the entire Harris campaign seem to be this is fine. And anyone who lives out here knows that it's not fine. And you can show people graphs all you want. You can tell them that inflation has slowed, but the grocery prices haven't gone down and people are very unhappy. The human misery that is on the streets of San Francisco, it's not that it doesn't matter. It's that it's not unique. It's that it's happening everywhere. And the only people answering the question are the people on the right. If we're going to have any kind of chance at making it out of this, we really must concentrate on getting some kind of mainstream left. The Democratic Socialists are running a candidate for New York City mayor, and I have hopes that that might start some conversations, because if the choice is between massive change and staying the same, a lot of people are just going to opt for massive change without asking the questions that they should ask.
That was the journalist Laura Jadid, author of an article, The Shadowy Millions Behind San Francisco's Moderate Politics in the New Republic. Laura has a Substack, it seems everyone but me does, called Banned in Your Estate, and you can find it and links to her other work on her website, Laura Jadid, that's JEDEED.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. If you're going to San Francisco, was one from the Times of Changed file, Scott McKenzie's hippie classic, If You're Going to San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Flowers in Your Hair, from that legendary year, 1967. Next, water in California, one of the hottest political topics in that state at any time, and especially now with Los Angeles burning and the fire hydrants running dry. Right-wingers want to blame it all on dumb liberal politicians, a lesbian fire chief, and firefighters who aren't white men. Anything but climate change, the most obvious culprit, as well as overdevelopment and the grotesque mismanagement of water resources. The journalist Yasha Levine has spent years, along with the filmmaker Ronan Wernham, working on Pistachio Wars, a documentary on Stephen and Linda Resnick, proprietors of the wonderful company. The Resnicks are billionaires who live in a giant mansion in Beverly Hills and grow pomegranates, there behind the distinctively bottled palm juice, pistachios, and other crops on land in the Central Valley of California. They are exemplars of the privatization of water rights in the state and the use of that scarce resource to grow crops that are anything but essential. They also import Fiji water from that impoverished island. Yasha Levine. You know, I just read an article on the Fortune website that could have been written by the Resnick's PR department. The headline, claims about a billionaire couple herding efforts to fight the LA fires via their control of the water supply are false. Are these claims false?
I mean, they're not directly to blame for the lack of water in the fire hydrants in Los Angeles. I mean, that is a kind of a strange thing that people glommed onto and kind of a connection that people seem to make or just assumed it was there just because these billionaires who live in Beverly Hills, live in LA, control all this water further up north in the Central Valley, the agricultural region. Because they control it, it's like LA isn't getting it. That's not really true just because LA is one of the most rapacious plunderer of water in California. It is the biggest sort of user of water in terms of just how much it controls, like as a single entity. There's actually quite a lot of water that it has in reserve in different reservoirs. So it isn't about that. But I think that when people make the connection between the fires in a semi-desert, semi-arid environment in like Los Angeles is, and the fact that in the state a private corporation can own and control more water than millions and millions of people use in a year, is an interesting connection to make, because the fact that LA can exist and the fact that these farmers can exist and become billionaires off of their farming operations are connected because they're all connected to the same aqueduct system. They're all connected to the same water system that makes both suburban development and suburban sprawl possible, like in LA, and makes industrial agriculture possible in California. So there is a connection to them. It's not super direct like people think, but there is a connection. Yeah.
You have a bit in the movie about the Owens Valley, Owens River, which feeds LA, right? How's that fit in?
LA has some water of its own. There's the LA River. There's some underground water supplies that it has. But it doesn't have enough water to sustain a massive urban or suburban environment. What happened at the turn of the century, about 100 years ago, is that a bunch of people who controlled Los Angeles politics and owned a lot of the land in Los Angeles, people like Harry Chandler, who was sort of one of the owners of the LA Times, they engaged in this conspiracy to go up, buy up land in an area that's about 350 miles east of Los Angeles in the mountains, in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And they bought up a bunch of ranch land from farmers up there who were just ranchers. And the reason they bought that land up was that it surrounded a water source. It surrounded a river. And so LA, undercover, basically using fake names and fake people to buy up land so it doesn't seem like there's a concerted effort to buy up this land is going on. They bought up land hundreds of miles away from Los Angeles and essentially put a fence around it and said, well, hey, ranchers, hey, farmers who live up in the mountains here, you're not getting any more of this water because we own all the water rights. And then LA built an aqueduct from the mountains all the way to Los Angeles. And that allowed Los Angeles to open up what is now known as the Valley, which is sort of the valley just north of Los Angeles, known for the Valley accent and, you know, all the good stuff that LA produced, porn and things like that. And so it opened up like a vast, vast suburban stretch of land that was then immediately developed, immediately turned into suburban tract homes. And in part, I think also helped create the development that's burning right now because LA doesn't have enough water to sustain massive development. So you need to bring water from somewhere else to build homes. And the homes that are burning wouldn't have been built on the scale that they have been in Los Angeles without this water. That was just the first location that Los Angeles got its water from about 100 years ago. Later on, it tapped that water supply and it basically needed more water. So it's later connected to the Colorado River, which is in a different state altogether. And then there's a third aqueduct that's run by the state of California that brings water to Los Angeles from 550 miles north of LA, something like that, from the mountains way up north, even further north in the Bay Area. And so you have Los Angeles as this kind of octopus suburban sprawl that, because it's in an area that gets very little water, it needs to bring water from somewhere else. And so it's tapped regions hundreds and hundreds of miles away from itself. So it's this kind of imperial octopus sucking water from all over the place in order to survive and to build these suburbs that are burning now.
So now turning to the stars of this documentary, the Resniks. Who are the Resniks?
They're just family farmers, you know?
Yes. Simple folk. Yes.
They're business people. I don't know. They're business people and highly motivated business people. They're an interesting couple. All right. They're from the East Coast. Originally, both of them, they came at different times. Linda Resnick actually comes from a kind of a Hollywood family. I think she's originally from Philadelphia, but her father made one of the best American films of all time, I think, The Blob. It's a cool horror movie. So her dad was a producer for that film. She came to Hollywood with him as a child. She was highly motivated to be a successful business person. She started a marketing agency when she was fairly young. She hung out with some Rand Corp people. And in fact, one of the people who leaked the Pentagon Papers, she was dating him at the time. And Pentagon Papers actually were Xeroxed at her marketing agency, at the Xerox machine that she had in her marketing agency. Anyway, so she was around LA, around Beverly Hills, around sort of Hollywood circles. And she ran into Stuart. He was a business guy who had a couple of different companies and she was trying to get his business. She was trying to do marketing for him. And they met and they fell in love. And he was kind of a guy on the make. He came from New Jersey, a Jewish family, pretty simple roots. And he's very, very cagey. He never gives interviews, never. But in the times that he actually was playing around with maybe getting a guy to write a biography of him for him, he gave a series of interviews. And in those series of interviews, it came out that his dad was at least peripheral to the Jewish mob in New Jersey, or there was some mob connection that was the world that he came up from. Well, his first successful business was a janitorial business. And it was very strange because this guy comes to study at UCLA business school with apparently no money. And then he just starts a janitorial business and it grows into one of the largest janitorial businesses in LA. He sells it for millions of dollars. We're talking about in the 1960s. He parlays that into starting an armed security company and builds that into the largest armed security company, private security company in LA, and has like the chief of police on his payroll. There's accusations of some employees of the company being involved in running heroin through LAX and all this stuff. So there's kind of this like underworld vibe to his early business ventures, you know? When him and Linda get together, I mean, they really are in love and they almost have like an equal partnership. They run their business together. They strategize together. He's sort of the scary business guy who like basically intimidates competitors. And she's the marketing brains and the PR brains behind the operation. And so they do weird stuff. Like they get into trinkets. They get into like the flower business. And then they buy up some land in the 70s to protect some of their money from inflation. And that's when their career as family farmers begins.
And now they produce massive amounts of pomegranates and pistachios, right? That's where much of their money comes from.
Pistachios, almonds, various kinds of citrus. They have wineries. They own one of the most iconic bottled water companies in America, Fiji Water, that brings water from the distant island of Fiji.
Which always seemed like an insane environmental crime to ship water from Fiji to American supermarkets.
Totally. Yeah, no, it's crazy. And it's also environmental, but also, and I think a kind of an economic and an imperial crime as well, because Fiji is a poor nation. And as I understand it, a big chunk of the population actually lacks access to clean drinking water. It's pretty gnarly. And so they have other things. They have some kind of agricultural, like chemical, you know, side business that they engage in, because they are a vertically integrated agribusiness. By sheer acres, they're like one of the largest farmers in America. They own like, you know, hundreds of square miles of land in the Central Valley. They do their own distribution. They do their own branding. I mean, they are like a fully vertically integrated conglomerate, you could call it. But it's all privately owned by the family. It's not publicly traded or anything like that.
And she is a marketing whiz.
Yeah, she's. I mean, she clearly has a talent. She single-handedly, you could say, convinced Americans to eat pistachios. Before the Resniks got this land for cheap from these oil companies that didn't want the land, and they started playing around with the crops that they had growing on there, she realized, wait a second, we could create a market. We could grow a nut and sort of market it with our own brand and really advertise this thing, you know, create it into kind of a product that people think they need. They did that single-handedly. Before them, no one in America ate pistachios. Pistachios was like a thing that people from Iran or Middle East ate as part of their, you know, cuisine, their regional cuisine. But it wasn't anything that Americans ate on any kind of scale.
In the documentary, you visit Victorville, which was a boom town during the housing bubble like 15 years ago. But the town ran out of water. How did Victorville run out of water?
This is kind of the origin story of my whole interest in water politics and in the way that water goes hand in hand with growth and development and capitalism and just generally the kind of the West Coast culture of America, how it developed. I mean, so Victorville was a subprime suburb, as I like to call it. You know, it was built in the run-up to the financial crash of 2007-2008 in the middle of the desert. If you go to the edge of Los Angeles's sort of suburban sprawl, and then you go another half an hour past that, you will hit Victorville. It's like the sort of the ultimate frontier of the vast growth of suburbs that is the Los Angeles area. It's in this open desert in the Mojave Desert. It's very far away from anything. There are no jobs there. No, there's no ecosystem there. But what it did have is some water and very, very cheap land. And so these big home builders in cahoots with Wall Street picked it as a place where you just build a bunch of cheap homes. And then you sell it to poor people using these subprime mortgages or, you know, adjustable rate mortgages that will start out very cheap, you know, in the first few years. And then the rates will increase after that and basically make those houses unaffordable. This entire city of about 100,000 people was built not really to house anyone, but to provide mortgages for Wall Street to package and to sell to investors. So I moved there just because I was fascinated with the collapse of the real estate crash. And I wanted to live in one of these towns that was essentially created to feed the speculative frenzy on Wall Street. And when I was there, I realized that there was like a kind of a problem that the town was having. It that expanded so quickly, it outstripped its water supplies. The town started, you know, was panicking, and then they were looking for somewhere to buy extra water so that people's taps didn't run dry. And they found a seller, a farmer, whose headquarters were like way up in Silicon Valley, but who was also a major of family farmers. They're also extremely wealthy and they owned vast acreages in the Central Valley and they controlled a huge amount of water. I traced that water sale and I found out that this farmer, the Vidovich family, they were part of this like clique of really powerful farmers, you know, usually billionaires, that own a private water bank in California. And that water bank allows them to be kind of like bankers, but in the water trade. Water gets delivered there by the state. So it's water that's sort of nominally public and controlled by the public. But once it goes into their water bank, it becomes privatized. It becomes deregulated. The state doesn't really have any more say about what can be done with this water. And so that water can either be used to grow crops on their fields, at least for these farmers, or it can be sold to municipalities who need it. That's the connection, you know, I made between the Resniks and sort of suburban development and real estate speculation and Wall Street. They're all kind of rolled up into one apparatus. I don't know, for the lack of a better word.
I'm speaking with Yasha Levine, co-director of the documentary Pistachio Wars. You spent a lot of time tooling around the Central Valley, which is a huge swath of agricultural land that has made many people very rich, or some people very rich, rather. But the place itself looks pretty busted. What's the Central Valley look like?
The Central Valley is one of the poorest regions in America. And it's not coincidental that most of the people who live there work in the agricultural trade as hired hands. And so you have, on the one hand, these vast plantations. I don't even want to call them farms. They're like plantations. The size of them just boggles the mind. I mean, the Resniks own land like that's, I think, 10 times the size of Manhattan, just to give people a sense of the scale of their farming operations. I mean, it's literally horizon to horizon. Like, even if you put a drone up in the air, you can't see like the borders of the farmland. People toil on these farms, you know, doing various things. They pick pistachios, they pick citrus fruit, lettuce, they pick sort of different things. They labor for a very, very small number of billionaire families for the most part. All the wealth that people there produce is just gets sucked out completely and, you know, gets funneled to LA, to San Francisco, to all of these sort of power centers, and nothing gets left there. And so the people who work there are essentially living in a kind of a poison environment where you have overlapping industries of the agriculture industry, which uses a lot of chemicals, a lot of hormones, a lot of things, pesticides, fertilizer to grow these sort of industrial crops. So it's heavily polluted. And then in large parts of the Central Valley where this farming takes place is actually the oil industry is very active. And so you have oil infrastructure, you have oil derricks, you have oil pumps, you have refineries, you have all these different things right there side by side with the agriculture industry. And so you have workers living with their families in trailers and in the apartment buildings in a very toxic environment. And frequently they don't even have access to clean drinking water, because the water that they have in the taps is pumped from the underground and it's contaminated and all these things. It's a really bleak place.
The water, it rots the plumbing fixtures. It's so toxic.
Exactly, yeah. And this is what you're referencing is Lost Hills. It's this little town called, it's not even a town, it's unincorporated. So just like a community of, at the intersection of two highways, essentially like a little settlement. And the settlement is owned by the wonderful company. The wonderful company is owned by Linda and Stuart Resnick, the Resnick family. So they kind of own this town. The majority of the people who live there work for the wonderful company. The wonderful company's field surrounded. People who live in this town, who work for one of the wealthiest people in California, these people who live in like the largest mansion in Beverly Hills, if you can imagine. The mansion is so large, they actually destroyed two neighboring properties. They bought three properties and they level it. So it's like, it's the biggest thing in Beverly Hills. And you have these people who work for them who make, you know, above minimum wage. The water that comes out of their faucets is literally rot you from the inside out. And 15 feet away from us is this pristine concrete river with this sparkling water that's brought in from the mountains, you know, north of San Francisco. Clean mountain drinking water. But they can't touch it. That stuff goes to the fields. That's used for irrigation. And so you have the state, and that water is brought by a state aqueduct, controlled by the state, funded and subsidized by the taxpayers of California. And so you have this total mismatch. You have this water that's being delivered to these billionaires, pristine, clean water from the mountains, delivered to these billionaires so they can grow pistachios. And yet, like the people who are actually doing the work, they're stuck with water that they can't even drink.
They're growing these food crops, though, on top of oil waste, and the groundwater is all polluted. And it seems like a grotesque place to grow food products.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's like if you want to like not ever eat American produce ever again, I recommend going out to the Central Valley and spending an afternoon there just looking around. The Resniks in particular, because there's different parts of the Central Valley, and the Central Valley that they operate in, the driest part, this most southernmost part of the Central Valley, is where the oil historically has been. The land that they bought they bought off oil companies. So the oil companies like reserved the mineral rights, right? So everything that's underground in terms of oil and things like that. But they sold the surface rights and the water rights to the Resniks. And the Resniks got it cheap because it's just land that sits on top of oil fields. But they turned it into productive agricultural land. So you have these farms, you know, these pistachio farms surrounding oil pumps. It even gets gnarlier than that. I mean, they irrigate their crops in certain parts with water that's pumped out of oil wells, because there's a lot of water and brine and stuff like that underground that sort of gets pumped up with actual petroleum. They use that water to actually irrigate their crops. Like, you can smell the petroleum like on the water. It's like, smells like, you know, you're at a gas station or something. This is treated as food, you know, these are edible products.
The pomegranate juice that is one of their signature products, you know, it's marketed as something really healthy, almost magically health-giving, and it's grown in this hideous environment.
Yeah, and they're full of shit too, because that's grown in these hideous environments, and this healthy pomegranate juice, it's like the pomegranate juice was their first, I think, big hit in terms of them being able to like take a generic pomegranate and like create a whole brand identity around it with this cute bottles and all this stuff. They did a heavy marketing campaign where they were saying that pomegranate juice, you know, cures prostate cancer and all this stuff. So if you drink it, you'll be healthy. The juice itself is actually made from concentrate. So it's already like a fake level of like health claims. But the FDA fined them and told them to cease and desist with their false health claims that they do around their pomegranate juice. The Resniks funded these scientists to come up with these bogus studies that promote the fact that they're healthy. So they're like not in the health industry. They're in the marketing industry. They're just about creating a sense of health around their products. But these products are not healthy at all. I mean, they're not organic. That's number one. But they're grown in one of the most toxic environments that I've ever seen. You wouldn't want to live there. I wouldn't want to plant my own like tomatoes there, because it's just how toxic it is. Who would want to eat tomatoes being grown on an oil field?
I believe you say in the documentary that their farms use enough water in a year to supply San Francisco for 10 years.
Yeah.
That's an immense amount of water in a state that is chronically short of it. And these are not essential food products. These are luxury goods, snacks that have been, demand has been juiced up with really clever marketing. It's really, grotesque is a word that comes to mind here.
If I roll it back a little bit, there's a kind of a basic problem that I think exists in the way that water gets allocated in California, is that ostensibly water is a public resource. Water is moved around and distributed using public infrastructure. Public infrastructure that is managed and run by people appointed by democratically elected governor. So there's like ostensibly a whole democratic system that operates these things. But in reality, the way that water gets allocated and who controls the system is controlled and dictated by a small oligarchy that runs California. And the way that they use water is just purely about the profit motive, about what will make me the most money, what will make them the most money, right? That's how they think about it. And so there isn't like a public benefit concern. There isn't anything. It's like, okay, yeah, well, we don't have that much water this year, but we need to feed people, right? So what are the crops that we're going to grow that will maximize nutrients for our population, right? That will make Californians and Americans happy and healthy while protecting the environment and all these different things. None of that gets discussed, right? It's like whatever makes the most money for these farmers who control this water is what this water gets used for. And so that's why pistachios emerged as a phenomenon, because it's a very, very high value crop. You plant these orchards, you wait until the trees mature. It takes several years for them to mature. I think even up to 7 years, I believe. But when they finally start producing, you can sell those pistachios for a lot of money. That's what happens in this kind of perverse system, right? Where you just use resources for, it's like a staple of any kind. You know, it's a snack food. It's just a snack food. It could easily be replaced with, I don't know, peanuts or something, or walnuts or whatever, right? And a lot of the pistachios are actually exported abroad. And so what you actually have is you're taking water in California, which is fairly scarce, and you're exporting it through the pistachios. There was actually kind of an interesting component to this. The only time that people get upset at these sort of water exports by proxy, right? Because when you grow something with water in California and then you export it, you're essentially exporting water, is that the Saudi Arabia bought up a huge chunks of land to grow alfalfa. And then that alfalfa was shipped to Saudi Arabia to feed cows in Saudi Arabia so they can produce milk. And so there was a kind of a nationalist or kind of a nativist freak out about that. You know, people are like saying, wait a minute, you know, you have these Saudis buying up all this land, taking our water, right? And essentially shipping water to themselves, right? Because they didn't want to use their own water to grow alfalfa in Saudi Arabia. They'd rather do it in America where it's easier and cheaper to do it. And so, but none of this gets discussed when you have like an American billionaire doing this, the same thing.
The end of the movie shows a San Francisco skyline with a red fog of wildfire smoke from 2020, and then cuts to Linda talking about making a memento mori, a reminder of death. It's really quite a powerful ending in the current context of the LA fires. I mean, what, having been immersed in California water politics for the last decade or so, what are you thinking about when you see these fires in LA?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking it's a huge, huge tragedy, but the industrial utopian dream is catching up to the West Coast of America. I mean, I think LA and a lot of California, the way it's been developed, is barely predicated on this idea that humans could master nature, that you could create these vast aqueducts, you could build these colossal dams, and you could move water around the state. You could take water from where there's a lot of water in the mountains and bring it to these arid areas where you can have farms, you can have cities, but you go against sort of the natural flow of things. LA, and I think just generally the rest of the world, because LA is just sort of the, you know, one of the examples of it, is sort of hitting this wall. It's like, yes, we can manipulate nature, but there are repercussions. If you build suburban developments in the mountains in LA, in mountains that normally burn under sort of the natural cycle of things, if you bring water from hundreds of miles away to build these suburbs in the mountains, at some point they're going to burn. You know, at some point you're not going to be able to hold off the fires. For me, it is looking at it, why I think this movie is important and kind of bigger than just the LA fires or just LA waters. I think it looks at the limit that we're coming up to. You know, we've been sort of denying nature, essentially. Ever since the Industrial Revolution really began, we've been sort of pushing against the limits of nature and believing that human civilization doesn't need to pay attention to that and we can transcend it. But I think nature has a way of reasserting itself, or limits have a way of reasserting themselves. And that's sort of what we're seeing in Los Angeles, as tragic as it is.
Nature is biting back.
Yep.
That was the journalist Yasha Levine, co-director of the documentary Pistachio Wars, along with Rowan Wernham. You can find a link to watch it on Yasha's website, yashalevine.com, or on the movie's website, pistachiowars.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Los Angeles' Burning by Bad Religion from 2004. Apparently, they didn't think the threat was serious 20 years ago. Till next week. Bye.